Deliver one man as he likes. David Mason, the 12th Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, down inside of Patel down in Hill, Texas. Today is February 10, 2017, or is Adar 14, 2020. We will start our first service today of the song entitled, I'll Go Where You Want Me to Go. It may not be on the mountain's height, or over the stormy sea. It may not be at the battle's front, nor you will have need of me. For in the still small voice he calls, who paths I do not know. I'll answer to Yah with my hand and God. I'll go where you want me to go. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Yah, for a mountain or plain or sea. I'll say what you want me to say, dear Yah. I'll be what you want me to be. Perhaps today there'll be a loving night, which Yahshua would have me spin. There may be now over the paths of sin some wonder whom I should see. Oh, Savior, if thou wilt be my guide, the dark and the rugged the way, my voice will echo the mercy sweet. I'll say what you want me to say. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Yah, on a mountain or plain or sea. I'll say what you want me to say, dear Yah. I'll be what you want me to be. There's surely somewhere a lonely place, in our harvest field so wild, where I may labor through last dark day, for Yahshua the crucified. So trust in my all unto thy care, I know thou lovest me. I'll do the will of the hearts and say, I'll be what you want me to be. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Yah, on a mountain or plain or sea. I'll say what you want me to say, dear Yah. I'll be what you want me to be. Part 5, this is talking about the captivity and restoration. We're on the subject of the voice of stern rebuke. Prophets and Kings, Ellen G. White. We're on page 138. Greatly terrified, Obadiah exclaimed, what have I sinned that thou wouldest deliver thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? Take such a message as this to the Ahab was to court a certain death, and the Yahweh the Elohim liveth, as the Yahweh the Elohim liveth, he explained unto the prophet, there is no nation or kingdom whither my master hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said, he is not there, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they found thee not. And now thou sayest, go tell thy master, behold, Elijah is here. And it shall come to pass as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of Yahweh shall carry thee whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he shall slay me. Honestly, Obadiah pleaded the prophet not to urge him. I, thy servant, he urged, fear the Yahweh from my youth. Was it not told my master that I did what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Yahweh, how I hid 100 men of the Yahweh's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with the bread and water? And now thou sayest, go tell thy master, behold, Elijah is here, and he shall slay me. With a solemn oath, Elijah promised Obadiah that the errand should not be in vain. As the Yahweh of the host liveth, before whom I stand, he declared, I will surely show myself unto him today. Okay, it says, thus assured, Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him. In astonishment mingled with the terror, the king listened unto the message from the man whom he feared and hated, and for whom he had sought so untiringly. Well, he knew that Elijah would not endanger his life merely for the sake of meeting him. Could it be possible that the prophet was about to utter another woe against Israel? For the king's heart was seized with the dread. He remembered the withered arm of Jeroboam. Ahab could not avoid obeying the summons. Neither dared he lift up his hand against the messenger of the Yahweh. And so, accompanied by a bodyguard of the soldiers, the trembling monarch went to meet the prophet. The king and the prophet stand face to face. Though Ahab is filled with a passionate hatred, yet in the presence of the Elijah he seems unmanned, powerless. In his first faltering words, art thou he that troubleth Israel? He unconsciously reveals the inmost feelings of his heart. Ahab knew that it was by the word of Yahweh that the heaven had become as brass. Yet he sought to cast upon the prophet the blame for the heavy judgments resting on the land. It is natural for the wrongdoer to hold the messengers of Yahweh responsible for the calamities that come as a sure result of the departure from the way of righteousness. Those who place themselves in Satan's power are unable to see things as Yahweh sees them. When the mirror of the truth is held up before them, they become indignant at the thought of receiving reproof. Blinded by sin, they refuse to repent. They feel that Elohim's servants have turned against them and are worthy of the severest censure. Standing in their conscious innocence before Ahab, Elijah makes no attempt to excuse himself or to flatter the king. Nor does he seek to evade the king's wrath by the good news that the drought is almost over. He has no apology to offer. Indignant and jealous for the honor of the Yahweh, he casts back the imputation of the Ahab, fearlessly declaring to the king that it is his sins and the sins of his fathers that have brought upon Israel this terrible calamity. I have not troubled Israel, Elijah boldly asserts, but thou and thy father's house, and that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Yahweh, and thou hast followed Balaam. Today there is need of the voice of the stern rebuke, for the grievous sins have separated the people from the Yahweh. Infidelity is fast becoming fashionable. We will not have this man to reign over us, is the language of the thousands. Luke 19:14. The smooth sermons so often preached make no lasting impression. The trumpet does not give a certain sound. Men are not cut to the heart by the plain, sharp truths of the Elohim's word. There are many professed Christians who, if they should express their real feelings, would say, what need is there of speaking so plainly? They might as well ask, why need John the Baptist have said unto the Pharisees, O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Luke 3:7. Why need that? He hath provoked the anger of the Herodias by telling Herod that it was unlawful for him to live with his brother's wife. The forerunner of the Yahshua lost his life by his plain speaking. Why could he not have moved along without incurring the displeasure of those who were living in sin? So men who should be standing as faithful guardians of Yahweh's law have argued till policy has taken the place of the faithfulness and sin is allowed to go unreproved. When will the voice of the faithful rebuke be heard once more in the church? Thou art the man. 2 Samuel 12:7. Words as unmistakably plain as these spoken by Nathan unto David are seldom heard in the pulpits of the day, seldom seen in the public press. If they were not so rare, we should see more of the power of Yahweh revealed among men. For the Yahweh's messengers should not complain that their efforts are without fruit until they repent of their own love of the approbation and their desire to please men, which leads them to suppress truth. Those ministers who are men-pleasers who cry, peace, peace, when Elohim has not spoken peace, might well humble their hearts before Yahweh, asking pardon for their insincerity and their lack of moral courage. It is not from love for their neighbor that they smooth down the message entrusted unto them, but because they are self-indulgent and ease-loving. True love seeks first the honor of the Yahweh and the salvation of the soul. Those who have this love will not evade the truth to save themselves from the unpleasant results of the plain speaking. When souls are in peril, Yahweh's ministers will not consider self, but will speak the word given them to speak, refusing to excuse or palliate evil. Would that every minister might realize the sacredness of his office and the holiness of his work, and show the courage that Elijah showed. As divinely appointed messengers, ministers are in a position of the awful responsibility. They are to reprove, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering, 2 Timothy 4:2. And Yahshua said they are to labor as stewards of the mysteries of the heaven, encouraging the obedient and warning the disobedient. With them, our worldly policy is to have no weight. Never are they to swerve from the part in which Yahshua has bidden them walk. They are to go forward in the faith, remembering that they are surrounded by a cloud as a witness. They are not to speak their own words, but words of which one greater than the potentates of the earth has bidden them speak. Their message is to be, thus saith Yahweh. Yahweh calls for men like to Elijah, Nathan, and John the Baptist, men who will bear his message with faithfulness, regardless of the consequences, men who will speak the truth bravely, though it call for the sacrifice of all they have. Men cannot use men who, in the time of peril, when the strength, courage, and influence of all are needed, are afraid to take a firm stand for the right. He calls for men who will do faithful battle against wrong, warn against principalities and powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against the spiritual wickedness in the high places. It is to such as these that he will speak the words, well done, good and faithful servant, enter thou into the joy of thy master. Matthew 25:23. End of chapter 10, chapter 11, Carmel. Standing before Ahab, Elijah demanded that all Israel be assembled to meet him. and the prophets of the Baal and Asherah on the Mount Carmel. Send, he commanded, and gathered unto me all Israel unto Mount Carmel. And the prophets of Baal, 450, and the prophets of the groves, 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. The command was issued by one who seemed to stand in the very presence of the Yahweh, and Ahab obeyed at once, as if the prophet were monarch and the king a subject. Swift messengers were sent throughout the kingdom with the summons to meet Elijah. And the prophets of Baal and Asherah in every town and village, the prophet prepared to assemble at the appointed time. As they journeyed toward the place, the hearts of many were filled with a strange foreboding. Something unusual was about to happen. Else, why this summons to great together at Carmel? What new calamity was about to fall upon the people and the land? Before the drought, Mount Carmel had been a place of the beauty. Its streams fed from never-fading springs, and its fertile slope covered with the fair flowers and flourishing groves. But now its beauty languished under a withering curse. The altars erected to the worship of Baal and Asherah stood now in the leafless groves on the summit of one of the highest ridges. In sharp contrast with these was a broken down altar of the Yahweh. Carmel overlooked a wide expanse of the country. Its heights were visible from many parts of the kingdom of Israel. At the foot of the mount there were vantage points from which could be seen much of what took place above, for the Yahweh had been signally dishonored by the idolatrous worship carried on under the cover of its wooded slopes, and Elijah chose this elevation as the most conspicuous place for the display of the Yahweh's power and for the vindication of the honor of his home, or honor of his name. Early on the morning of the day appointed, the host of the apostate Israel in eager expectancy gathered near the top of the mountain. Jezebel's prophets march up in the imposing array. In regal pomp, the king appears and takes his position at the head of the priests, and the idolaters shout his welcome. You know what this is? Antitypical Elijah. This is going to happen again. These false prophets of the groves, the 400 that belongs to Jezebel, and the false prophets that belong to Ahab, the 450, they're represented by these false ministers in the Adventist Church. It's the Adventist Church. And this is going to happen again. Yahweh is going to have them gathered again before Elijah. This Elijah, Malachi 4:5, is coming back in the last days. They're going to be gathered again before him. And their heads are going to roll again. This is Ezekiel 9 going through the city. Going to literally destroy every false prophet in the Adventist Church. This is what this is all about. And this all started in 2002, July the 14th, 2002. It's when the prophecy fell on antitypical Ahab, Brother W. Johnson, July the 14th, 2002, at Kermit, Texas, Gilead Center, to restore the kingdom. I told him, restore the kingdom. That's exactly what I told him. I said, restore all of the daily. Restore. And I gave him instructions to get rid of your family members that are not with you in the kingdom, that are not supporting you. Your number one officer, Daniel, your son, that you anointed, and you had him ordained to be your associate pastor. All these years, get rid of him. And I told him what heaven's message was. He refused to do it, and so he represented antitypical Ahab. And judgment fell upon him and his wife, Laomai, which is antitypical Jezebel, fell upon her. So the judgment has fallen upon these false prophets in the Adventist church. So they have their day of coming, when they're going to have to stand before antitypical Elijah again. And then whenever they're cleaned out, when you drain the swamp of all of this debris, of these false prophets of Baal, then you'll have the 144,000 shine forth as the bright stars of the morning in the kingdom of the heaven that is set up here on this earth, upon the Mount Zion, in the 12th hour, with the Lamb, Revelation 14, 1 and 2. But there is apprehension in the hearts of the priests, as they remember that at the word of the prophet, the land of Israel for 3 years and a half has been destitute of the dew and rain. Some fearful crisis is at hand. They feel sure the gods in whom they have trusted have been unable to prove Elijah a false prophet. To their frantic cries, their prayers, their tears of humiliation, their revolting ceremonies, their costly and ceaseless sacrifices, the objects of their worship have been strangely indifferent. Facing King Ahab and the false prophets and surrounded by the assembled host of the Israel, Elijah stands, the only one who has appeared to vindicate the honor of the Yahweh, for whom the whole kingdom has changed with its weight of the woe, is now before them, apparently defenseless in the presence of the monarch of Israel, the prophets of Baal, the men of war, and the surrounding thousands, but Elijah is not alone. Above around him are the protecting hosts of the heaven, angels that excel in strength. Unashamed and unterrified, the prophet stands before the multitude, fully aware of his commission to execute the divine command. His countenance is lighted with an awful solemnity. In the anxious expectancy, the people wait for him to speak, looking first upon the broken down altar of the Yahweh and then upon the multitude. Elijah cries out in the clear trumpet-like tone, "How long halt ye between two opinions? If the Yahweh be Yahweh, follow him, but if Baal, then follow him." The people answer him not a word. Not one in that vast assembly dare reveal loyalty unto the Yahweh. Like a dark cloud, deception and blindness had overspread Israel. Not all at once had this fatal apostasy closed about them, but gradually, as from time to time they had failed to heed the words of their warning and reproof that the Yahweh sent them to each departure from the right doing, each refusal to repent had deepened their guilt and driven them further from the heaven, and now in the crisis they persisted in refusing to take their stand for the Yahweh. Okay, it says, "For the Yahweh abhors indifference and disloyalty in a time of the crisis in his work." That's what happened at Kermit 2002, July the 14th. There was a crisis, and that's exactly what I told the prophet, brothers. I said, "The church is in crisis. Call a meeting today. Call them all in. Tell them to come up and deliver this message that I gave you from heaven. And repent and do what I told you." He refused to do it, and the rest is history. Harry says, the whole universe is watching with inexpressible interest the closing scenes of the great controversy between good and evil. The people of Yahweh are nearing the borders of the eternal world. What can be of more importance unto them than that they be loyal unto Yahweh of the heaven? All through the ages, Yahweh has had moral heroes. And he has them now, those who, like Joseph and Elijah and Daniel, are not ashamed to acknowledge themselves his peculiar people. His special blessing accompanies the labors of men of action, men who will not be swerved from the straight line of the duty, but who, with the divine energy, will inquire, who is on the Yahweh's side? Exodus 32:26. Men who will not stop merely with the inquiry, but who will demand that those who choose to identify themselves with the people of Yahweh shall step forward and reveal unmistakably their allegiance unto the King of Kings and the Yahweh of Yahweh's. That's what it says, Lord of Lords. So it means King of Kings and Sovereign of Sovereigns, yeah, or Deity of Deities. Such men make their wills and plans subordinate to the law of Yahweh. For love of Him, they count not their lives dear unto themselves. Their work is to catch the light from the Word and let it shine forth to the world in clear, steady rays. Fidelity to Yahweh is their motto. While Israel, on Carmel's doubt and hesitate, the voice of Elijah again breaks the silence. I only remain a prophet of Yahweh, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let them therefore give us two bullocks, and let them choose one bullock for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on wood, and put no fire under. And I will dress the other bullock, and lay it on wood, and put no fire under, and call you on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of Yahweh, and the Yahweh that answers by fire, let him be the Yahweh. The proposal of Elijah is so reasonable that the people cannot well evade it, so they find courage to answer. It is well spoken. The prophets of Baal dare not lift their voices in dissent, and addressing them, Elijah directs, choose you one bullock for yourselves and dress it first. For ye are many and call on the name of your gods, but put no fire under. Outwardly bold and defiant, but with terror in their guilty hearts, the false priests prepare their altar, laying on the wood and the victim, and then they begin their incantation. Their shrill cries echo and re-echo through the forest and the surrounding heights as they call on the name of their God, saying, O Baal, hear us. The priests gather about their altar, and with leaping and writhing and screaming, with the tearing of the hair and cutting of the flesh, they beseech their God to help them. Oh, help us, help us, help us, help us. The morning passes, noon comes, and yet there is no evidence that the Baal hears the cries of his deluded followers. There is no voice, no reply unto their frantic prayers. The sacrifice remains unconsumed, and they continue their frenzied devotion. The crafty priests are continually trying to devise some means by which they may kindle a fire upon the altar and lead the people to believe that the fire has come direct from Baal. But Elijah watches every movement, and the priests, hoping against hope for some opportunity to deceive, continue to carry on their senseless ceremony. It came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey, or peradventure he sleepeth, and must be awake. And they cried aloud, and cut themselves after their manner with knives and lances, till the blood gushed out upon them. And it came to pass, when midday was past, and they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, that there was neither voice nor any to answer, nor any that regarded. So when it come to the ninth hour, they've been crying out from the third hour to the ninth hour. For 6 hours now, they've been crying out. Okay. Gladly would Satan have come to the help of those whom he had deceived and who were devoted unto his service. Gladly would he have sent the lightning to kindle their sacrifice. But Yahweh has set Satan's bounds, restrained his power, and not all the enemy's devices can convey one spark unto Baal's altar. Alas, their voice is hoarse with the shouting, their garments stained with the blood from self-inflicted wounds, their priests become desperate. With the unbated frenzy, they now mingle with their pleading terrible cursings of their son God, and Elijah continues to watch intently, for he knows that if by any device the priest should succeed in kindling their altar fire, he would instantly be torn in pieces. Healing draws on, the prophets of Baal are weary, faint, confused, one suggests one thing and another something else, until finally they cease their effort. Their shrieks and curses no longer resound over Carmel. In despair, they retire from the contest. All day long, the people have witnessed the demonstrations of the baffled priest. They have beheld their wall leaping around the altar as if they would grasp the burning rays of the sun to serve their purpose. They have looked with horror on the frightful, self-inflicted mutilations of the priests, and have had opportunity to reflect on the follies of the idol worship. Many in the throng are weary of the exhibitions of the demonism, and they now await with the deepest interest the movements of the Elijah. It is the hour of the evening sacrifice, and Elijah bids the people come near unto me. As they tremblingly draw near, he turns unto the broken down altar where once men worshipped the Yahweh of heaven, and repairs it. Unto him the heap of the ruins is more precious than all the magnificent altars of the heathendom. In the reconstruction of this ancient altar, Elijah revealed his respect for the covenant that Yahweh made with the Israel when they crossed the Jordan into the Promised Land, choosing 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of the Yahweh, of the Jacob. He built an altar in the name of Yahweh. The disappointed priests of Baal, exhausted by their vain efforts, want to see what the Elijah will do. They hate the prophet for proposing a task that had exposed the weakness and inefficiency of their gods. Yet they fear his power. The people, fearful also and almost breathless with expectancy, watch while Elijah continues his preparation. The calm demeanor of the prophet stands out in a sharp contrast with the fanatical, senseless frenzy of the followers of Baal. The altar completed, the prophet makes a trench about it, and having put the wood in order and prepared the bullock, he lays the victim on the altar and commands the people to flood the sacrifice in the altar with water. Fill 4 barrels, he directed, and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood. And he said, do it the second time, and they did it the second time. And he said, do it the third time, and they did it the third time. And the water ran round about the altar, and he filled the trench also with the water, reminding the people of the long-continued apostasy that has awakened the wrath of the Yahweh. Elijah calls upon them to humble their hearts and to turn to the Elohim of their fathers, that the curse upon the land of Israel may be removed. Then, bowing reverently before the unseen Yahweh, he raises his hands toward the heaven and offers a simple prayer. Baal's priests have screamed and foamed and leaped from early morning until late in the afternoon, but as Elijah prays, no senseless shrieks resound over Carmel's high. He prays as if he knows Yahweh is there, a witness unto the saint, a listener unto his appeal. The prophets of the Baal have prayed, while incoherently. Elijah prays simply and fervently, asking Yahweh to show his superiority over Baal, that Israel may be led to turn unto him. Yahweh Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, the prophet prays, let it be known this day that thou art Yahweh in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Hear me, O Yahweh, hear me, that this people may know that thou art the Elohim, Yahweh Elohim, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. A silence, oppressive in its solemnity, rests upon all. The priest of Baal trembled with terror. Conscious of their guilt, they look for swift retribution. No sooner is the prayer of Elijah ended than the flames of the fire, brilliant flashes of lightning, descend from the heaven upon the upreared altar, consuming the sacrifice, licking up the water and the trench, and consuming even the stones of the altar. The brilliancy of the blaze illumines the mountain and dazzles the eyes of the multitude. In the valleys below, where many are watching in the anxious suspense, the movements of those above, the descent of the fire is clearly seen, and all are amazed at the sight, for it resembles the pillar of the fire which at the Red Sea separated the children of Israel from the Egyptian host. The people on the mount prostrate themselves in the awe before the unseen Yahweh. They dare not continue to look upon the heaven-sent fire. They fear that they themselves will be consumed and convicted of their duty for the acknowledging of the Elohim of Elijah. And as the Elohim of their fathers unto whom they owe allegiance, they cry out together with one voice, Yahweh, he is the Yahweh, Yahweh, he is the Yahweh. With startling distinctness, the cry resounds over the mountain and echoes in the plain below. At last Israel is aroused, undeceived, penitent. At last the people see how greatly they have dishonored Yahweh. The character of Baal worship, in contrast with the reasonable service required by the true Yahweh, stands fully revealed. The people recognize Elohim's justice and mercy in the withholding the dew and the rain until they have been brought to confess his name. They are ready now to admit that the Elohim of Elijah is above every idol. The priest of Baal witnessed with the consternation the wonderful revelation of the Jehovah, of the Yahweh's power. Yet even in their fixture, and in the presence of the divine glory, they refused to repent of their evil doing. They would still remain the prophets of Baal. Thus they showed themselves ripe for the destruction, that repentant Israel may be protected from the allurements of those who have taught them to worship Baal. Elijah is directed by the Yahweh to destroy these false teachers. The anger of the people has already been aroused against the leaders in transgression. And when Elijah gives the command, take the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape, they are ready to obey. They seize the priests and take them to the brook Kishon. And there before the close of the day that marked the beginning of the decided reform, the ministers of Baal are slain. Not one is permitted to live. From Jezreel unto Horeb, chapter 12. We just finished chapter 11. Chapter 12, from Jezreel to Horeb, with the slaying of the prophets of Baal, the way was opened for carrying forward a mighty spiritual reformation among the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom. Elijah had set before the people their posse. He had called upon them to humble their hearts and turn to Yahweh. The judgments of heaven had been executed. The people had confessed their sins and had acknowledged the Elohim of their fathers as the living Elohim. And now the curse of heaven was to be withdrawn and the temporal blessings of life renewed. The land was to be refreshed with the rain. Get thee up, eat and drink, Elijah said unto Ahab, for there is a sign of the abundance of rain. Then the prophet went to the top of the mount to pray. It was not because of any outward evidence that the showers were about to fall that Elijah could so confidently bid Ahab prepare for the rain. The prophet saw no clouds in the heavens. He heard no thunder. He simply spoke the word that the Spirit of Yahweh had moved upon him to speak. In response unto his own strong faith throughout the day, he had unflinchingly performed the will of Yahweh and had revealed his implicit confidence in the prophecies of the Elohim's word. And now, having done all that was in his power to do, he knew that heaven would freely bestow the blessings foretold. For the same Yahweh who had sent the drought had promised an abundance of rain as a reward of the right doing, and now Elijah waited for the promised outpouring. In an attitude of humility, his face between his knees, he interceded Yahweh in behalf of the penitent Israel. Again, Elijah sent his servants to point over to a point overlooking the Mediterranean, to learn whether there were any visible token that Elohim had heard his prayer. Each time the servant returned with the word, "There is nothing." The prophet did not become impatient or lose faith, but continued his earnest pleading. Six times the servant returned with the word that there was no sign of the rain in the brassy heaven. Undaunted, Elijah sent forth once more. And this time the servant returned with the word, "Behold, there arises a little cloud out of the sea like a man's hand." This was enough. Elijah did not wait for the heavens to gather blackness in that small cloud. He beheld by the faith and abundance of the rain. And he acted in harmony with his faith, sending his servant quickly unto Ahab with the message, "Prepare thy chariot and get thee down, that the rain stop thee not." It was because Elijah was a man of the large faith that the Elohim could use him in this grave crisis in the history of Israel. As he prayed, his faith reached out and grasped the promises of heaven, and he persevered in the prayer until his petitions were answered. He did not wait for the full evidence of that Yahweh had heard him, but was willing to venture all on the slightest token of the divine favor. And yet, what he was enabled to do under Elohim, all may do in this sphere of the activity and the Elohim's service for the prophet. From the mountains of the Gilead, it is written, Elijah was a man subject unto like passions as we are, and he prayed earnestly that it might not rain, and it rained not on the earth by the space of 3 years and 6 months. James 5:17. Faith such as this is needed in the world today. Faith that will lay hold on the promises of Yahweh's word and refuse to let go until heaven hears. Faith such as this connects us closely with heaven and brings us strength for the coping with the powers of the darkness. Through faith, Elohim's children have subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of wickedness were made strong, waxed violent in the fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Hebrews 11:33-34. And through the faith in the blood of the everlasting covenant, we today are to reach the heights of the Yahweh's purpose for us. if thou canst believe, all things are possible unto him that believeth. Mark 9:23. Faith is an essential element of the prevailing of prayer. He that cometh to Elohim must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. If we ask anything according unto his will, he heareth us. And if we know that he hear us, whatsoever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we desired of him. Hebrews 11:6, 1 John 5:14-15. With the persevering faith of the Jacob, with the unyielding persistence of the Elijah, we may present our petition unto the Father, claiming all that he has promised. The honor of his throne is staked for the fulfillment of his word. The shades of the night were gathering about Mount Carmel, as they had prepared for the descent. It came to pass in the meanwhile that the heaven was black with the clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went unto Jezreel. As he journeyed toward the royal city through the darkness and the blinding rain, Ahab was unable to see his way before him. Elijah, who, as the prophet of Elohim, had that day humiliated Ahab before his subjects and slain his idolatrous priest, still acknowledged him as the Israel's king, and now, as an act of homage and strengthened by the power of Yahweh, he ran before the royal chariot, guiding the king to the entrance of the city. And this gracious act of the Yahweh's messenger shown to a wicked king is a lesson for all who claim to be servants of Yahweh, but who are exalted in their own estimation. There are those who feel above performing duties that unto them appear menial. They hesitate to perform even needful service, fearing that they will be found doing the work of a servant. These have much to learn from the example of Elijah. By his word, the treasure of the heaven had been for 3 years withheld from the earth. He had been signally honored of Yahweh as an answer to his prayer on Carmel. Fire had flashed from heaven and consumed the sacrifice. His hand had executed the judgment of Yahweh and the slaying of the idolatrous prophet. His petition for the rain had been granted. And yet, after the signal triumph with which Elohim had been pleased to honor his public ministry, he was willing to perform the service of a menial. At the gate of the Jezreel, Elijah and Ahab separated. The prophet, choosing to remain outside the walls, wrapped himself in his mantle and lay down upon the bare earth to sleep. The king, passing within, soon reached the shelter of his palace, and there related unto his wife the wonderful events of the day and the marvelous revelation of the divine power that had proved to Israel that the Yahweh is the true Yahweh and Elijah his chosen messenger. As Ahab told the queen of the slain of the idolatrous prophets, Jezebel hardened and impenitent became infuriated. She refused to recognize in the events on the Carmel the overruling providence of Yahweh, and still defiant, she boldly declared that Elijah should die. That night a messenger aroused the weary prophet and delivered him the word of Jezebel. So let the gods do unto me, and more also, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. It would seem that after showing courage to so undaunted, after triumphing so completely over the king and priest and people, Elijah could never afterwards have given away to the despondency, nor been awed into the timidity, but he who had been blessed with so many evidences of Yahweh's loving care was not above the frailties of the mankind, and in this dark hour his faith and courage forsook him. Bewildered, he started from his slumber. The rain was pouring from the heaven. Heavens and darkness was on every side. Forgetting that 3 years before Yahweh had directed his course unto a place of the refuge from the hatred of Jezebel and the search of the Ahab, the prophet now fled for his life. Reaching Beersheba, he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. Elijah should not have fled from his post of duty. He should have met the threats of Jezebel with an appeal for the protection unto the one who had commissioned him to vindicate the honor of the Yahweh. He should have told the messenger that the Yahweh in whom he trusted would protect him against the hatred of the queen. Only a few hours had passed since he had witnessed a wonderful manifestation of the divine power. This should have given him assurance that he would not now be forsaken. He had, had he remained where he was, had he made Elohim his refuge and strength, standing steadfast for the truth, he would have been shielded from the harm. The Yahweh would have given him another signal victory by the sending of his judgments on Jezebel. And the impression made on the king and the people would have wrought a great reformation. Elijah had expected much from the miracle wrought on the Carmel. He had hoped that after this display of the Elohim's power, Jezebel would no longer have influence over the mind of Ahab, and that there would be a speedy reform throughout Israel. All day on Carmel's height he had toiled without food. Yet when he guided the chariot of Ahab to the gate of Jezreel, his courage was strong, despite the physical strain under which he had labored. It says, but a reaction such as frequently follows high faith and glorious success was pressing upon Elijah. He feared that the reformation begun on Carmel might not be lasting, and depression seized him. He had been exalted to Pisgah's top. Now he was in the valley. While under the inspiration of the Almighty, he had stood the severest trial of the faith. But in this time of discouragement, with Jezebel's threat sounding in his ears, and Satan still apparently prevailing through the plotting of this wicked woman, he lost his hold on Yahweh. He had been exalted above measure, and this reaction was tremendous. Forgetting Yahweh, Elijah fled on and on until he found himself in a dreary waste alone. Utterly wearied, he sat down to rest under a juniper tree, and sitting there he requested for himself that he might die. It is enough now, O Yahweh, he said. Take away my life, for I am not better than my father. A fugitive, far from the dwelling places of the men, his spirits crushed by the bitter disappointment, he desired never again to look upon the face of a man. At last, utterly exhausted, he fell asleep, and to the expense of all, there come times of keen disappointment and utter discouragement. Days are when sorrow is a portion, and it is hard to believe that Elohim is still the kind benefactor of his earth-born children. Days when the troubles harass the soul, still death seems preferable unto life. It is then that many lose their hold on Yahweh and are brought into the slavery of the doubt, the bondage of the unbelief. Could we at such times discern with the spiritual insight the meaning of the Elohim's providences, we should see angels seeking to save us from ourselves, striving to plant our feet upon a foundation more firm than the everlasting hills, and new faith, new life would spring into being. The faithful Job in the day of his affliction and darkness declared. The faithful Job. And the day of his affliction and darkness declared, let the day perish wherein I was born. Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed, and my calamity laid in the balances altogether. Oh, that I might have my request, and that Yahweh would grant me the thing that I long for, even that it would please Yahweh to destroy me. that it would be let loose his hand and curse me and cut me off, then I should have comfort. I will not refrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. My soul chooses death rather than my life. I loathe it. I would not live always. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. Job 3:3. Job 6:2-8-10. Job 7:11-15-16. But though weary of the life, Job was not allowed to die. Unto him were pointed out the possibilities of the future, and there was given him the message of the hope. Thou shalt be steadfast and shalt not fear, because thou shalt forget thy misery, and remember it as waters that pass away, and thine age shall be clearer than the noonday. Thou shalt shine forth, thou shalt be as the morning, and thou shalt be secure. Because there is hope, thou shalt lie down, and none shall make thee afraid. Yea, many shall make suit unto thee, but the eyes of the wicked shall fail, and they shall not escape, and their hope shall be as the giving up of the ghost. Job 11:15-20. From the depths of discouragement and despondency, Job rose to the heights of the implicit trust in the mercy and the saving power of Yahweh. Triumphantly he declared, though he slay me, yet will I trust in him. He also shall be my salvation. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see the Father, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. Job 13:15-16, 19:25-27. Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind, Job 38:1, and revealed unto his servant the might of his power. When Job caught a glimpse of his Creator, he abhorred himself and repented in dust and ashes. Then the Yahweh was able to bless him abundantly and to make his last years the best of his life. Hope and courage are essential to perfect service for Yahweh. These are the fruit of the faith. Despondency is sinful and unreasonable. Yahweh is able and willing more abundantly, Hebrews 6:17, to bestow upon his servants the strength they need for the test and trial. The plans of the enemies of his work may seem to be well laid and firmly established, but Yahweh can overthrow the strongest of these, and this he does in his own time and way. When he sees that the faith of his servants have been sufficiently tested, for the disheartened there is a sure remedy. Faith, prayer, work, faith and activity will impart assurance and satisfaction that will increase day by day. Are you tempted to give way to feelings of anxious foreboding or utter despondency? In the darkest days when the appearances seem most forbidding, fear not. Have faith in Yahweh. He knows your need. He has all power. His infinite love and compassion never weary. Fear not that he will fail of the fulfilling. His promise, he is eternal truth. Never will he change the covenant he has made with those who love him. And he will bestow upon his faithful servants the measure of the efficiency that their need demands. The Apostle Paul has testified. He said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities and in reproaches, in necessities and persecutions, in distresses for the Yahshua's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. 2 Corinthians 12:9-10. Yahweh did forsake Elijah. No, did Yahweh forsake Elijah in his hour of trial? Oh no. He loved his servant no less than Elijah felt himself forsaken of Yahweh. And man then, when in answer to unto his prayer, fire flashed from the heaven and illuminated the mountain top, and now as Elijah slept, a soft touch and a pleasant voice awoke him. He started up in terror as if to flee, fearing that the enemy had discovered him. But the pitying face bending over him was not the face of an enemy, but of a friend. Yahweh had sent an angel from heaven with the food for his servant. Arise and eat, the angel said. And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baking on the coals, and a the cruse of the water at his head. After Elijah had partaken of the refreshments prepared for himself, he slept again. The second time the angel came, touching the exhausted man, he said with a pitying tenderness, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee." And he arose and did eat and drink, and in the strength of that food he was able to journey 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of Yahweh, where he found refuge and a cave. This brings into the study fish hour contest at the 11th hour call, and I'm going to click on the audio archive. We're going to close now with a song entitled "Work for the Night is Coming." Work for the night is coming. Work through the morning hours. Work while the dew is sparkling. Work mid springing flowers. Work when the day grows brighter. Work in the glowing sun. Work, the night is coming. When man's work is done, work for the night is coming. Work through the sunny noon. Fill brightest hours with labor. Rest comes sure and soon. Give every flying matter something to keep in store. Work for the night is coming, when man works no more. Work for the night is coming, under the sunset sky. All their bright tents are glowing, work for daylight flies. Work till the last beam faded, faded to shine no more. Work night is darkening, when man's work is o'er.